I assume Captain Sisko removed or destroyed everything of value?
Not everything.
What is that?
A message from Sisko.
I don't understand.
He's letting me know he'll be back.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, smuggling as much Yamak sauce as he can.
And we have a very special guest, fresh from giving art lessons to the Vorta, Dave Boris.
I brought all the white, don't worry about it.
Oh Dave. My. David, it's been a long time since you were on the show. You're on one of our best episodes, Star Trek versus Star Wars.
Thank you.
Where did you come down on that argument? Refresh our memories here.
Oh, I came down on Star Wars, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. I came down on Star Trek, we left it to Cam. He was a tiebreaker. Cam, do you recall what you came down on?
I did come down on the side of Star Trek, but it was close.
It was close.
It was very close.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So go back to the archives. David, great to have you back on the show.
Thank
we're
you.
So
it's
excited. And we can't wait. You, I think, kind of inspired us a little bit, because I think you've been pushing us to do...
Nagging us is a better word.
Nagging us, yeah, totally, to kind of get in on this Dominion War action. It's literally the 20-year anniversary of it, so I think it's so phenomenal that you can return back to the show, and we can take a deep dive into the Dominion War arc. But thank you for joining us.
Yeah, well, it's my pleasure. I think I've texted and emailed Cam every few weeks asking about when the Dominion War episodes will be.
Cam's like, who is this? How'd you get my number?
Flying that plane to wave that banner outside my window twice a day got really obnoxious.
But I think your listeners should know that I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt right now.
That's true.
A final protest for my defeat. I could not convince one of you to join me. Tyler, I don't think you were ever going to come to
never,
the dark side.
Never.
But Cam was wavering.
You know, and who knows if we have to revisit that further down the road with Discovery coming out, as well as, you know, now we've seen, that was done before we saw The Force Awakens, I believe, as well as Rogue One. You know, Episode 8 coming out, The Last Jedi.
And the Han Solo.
Hate to disappoint, guys. Rogue One and Force Awakens, those aren't turning the corner for me. I just have to be honest here. And I don't think Han Solo is either.
What about Colin Trevorrow getting fired from Episode 8?
Okay, that
today.
Might actually do that. I hated Jurassic World, but I did love his film, Safety Not Guaranteed. So
that was better than Star Trek.
Yeah. Well, okay there. Guys, why don't we just jump into it? You know, I think we should also bring up how we're going to tackle this, because I think, you know, this is such an amazing sort of story arc here, and we want to talk about how this works as kind of a beginning, middle, end when we're talking about specifically kind of the seven episodes that make up this Dominion invasion arc, where we lose Deep Space Nine, becomes Tarek Norn. It's really the first string of episodes that the writers go full hog and do like this ongoing serialized arc where episode to episode, everything that happens matters. We had that three-part episode, The Siege, The Circle, and I'm blanking on the other name.
So am I.
But Cam, you and I, we tackled that in multi-part episodes earlier. This is going to be a bit of a different examination. So we're going to tackle it from, I think, an angle that it's going to help us prevent this from becoming an unwieldy episode, but we want to discuss how this impacted storytelling, whether there's some maybe mistakes made by the writers, and why maybe we love this Dominion War arc as well. And let me say this, I'm not a war lover at all. This is mostly like me showing appreciation for storytelling here in Star Trek. But Dave, you are a bit of a war buff, aren't you?
Well, I wouldn't say a war lover, let's put it that way. I am a military historian, and one of the things we do say to our students before we teach them about military history is the fact that studying war, or writing about war, or portraying war in art is not loving war. It's about trying to understand often the humanity behind war, the decisions made, why people make the decisions they do, why people are brave during war, and why people are cowards during war. And a lot of that gets played out in this, the idea of collaborationist and resistor, the idea of ally or enemy or neutral. And so a lot of the same issues that we would deal with in military history actually come out thematically in this arc.
Cam, he's so much more articulate than I am. I don't know why you keep me around on the show.
I have no idea either. Yeah.
Well, you know a lot more than I do there, Tyler.
Okay. You need to teach my girlfriend that line because she'll never say anything like that.
I won't get involved in
that. Okay, okay. But guys, let's jump into it. Let's start with episode number one here.
Yeah.
The season finale of season 5, Call to Arms. This is where they mine the wormhole. They see just all these Dominion convoys coming through. They mine the wormhole with Rom's brilliant idea of all people. And then that initially instigates kind of the formal hostilities between the Dominion and the Alpha Quadrant, and they lose Deep Space Nine. It's now going to be Tarak Nor. I think, we can get into kind of our highlights from this episode, but I think the thing that I really think is important here is the brilliance of the writers and how they handled where they're leaving all the characters at the very end of this episode. They split up the crew in so many magnificent, so many astounding ways that I think really leads to some great possibilities for storytelling. Just a few examples here, but in the end, we have Worf and Martok. They're on the Rotaran. Jadzia is separated from Worf. She's on the Defiant along with Sisko, O'Brien, Bashir, Nog, and even Garak.
Mm-hmm.
On the space station, we have Jake, of all people, staying behind, which we can dive into that because I think that's a very intriguing thing. Odo and Kira, of course, as well as Quark. He's not going to give up his bar. And then we also have the entry of Dukat retaking the station. He's been waiting 5 years for this. We have Weyoun and Damar coming along. So
yep.
I think it's fantastic how this sets up a lot of the pieces that are going to play out over the following 6 episodes to kick off the season premiere and so forth from season 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I really like about this setup is that, you know, DS9 is home to these people. And we see at the start, you know, horrible things are looming. The storm is coming in, but everyone is still like focused on their personal lives. You know, there's weddings being planned and, you know, all this
Rom and
stuff.
Rom and Lita,
yep. You know, Worf and Jadzia are talking about their future together. It reminded me a lot of the episode Balance of Terror from the original series, where at the start, yeah. Kirk is marrying these two crew members, and it's right before they're attacked by the Romulans. So it's sort of this, you know, peace before wartime idea. It's just that TOS obviously didn't have story arcs. Here we really get to see these people who, in the midst of this intergalactic absolute chaos, are still like remembering the humanity of who they are and pursuing it, you know, so much as we would see in stories about war, whether it's World War II or World War I, etc.
I like how you bring that up because this episode really kicks off with Odo and Kira having some angst with their own relationship. They're not a romantic pairing at this point, but Kira has found out that Odo does have feelings for her. And it is uncomfortable between the two. And I love it, Dave, like how these guys, no matter what the war looming the way it is, mm-hmm. they're focused, the writers are focused on who these people are as humans or aliens, but you know what I mean, like people. As people, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, one of the things that stands out to me when we talk about this sort of theme of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, humanity during wartime or people during wartime is the fact that, not just because the war is going on, it doesn't mean that there needs to be sort of like a cancellation of all their personal issues.
Yeah.
And these personal issues have to play out. And in fact, in many ways, during this arc, the personal issues are amplified, are they not? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it's more intense. Every time Jadzia or Worf or anyone goes on a mission or gets into a meeting or anything like that, the stakes are much higher. And this puts a lot more pressure on these relationships. And that allows the writers, in my opinion, to really play out, to really show these relationships being tested time and time again.
And by fragmenting them too, it intensifies sort of their desperation to get that back. And so, you know, so much of this arc is about these characters wanting to return home, and the desperation to achieve that becomes that much more intense.
Well, we also see Sisko really embracing the station as his home. And that's such a notable change in that character from where we met him in Emissary, where he wanted to be anywhere else but the station, but he's embracing his role as Emissary. He's saying, like, yeah, Rom, Lita, I will brush up on my Bajoran and I'll perform the ceremony that you guys want to have as well. I love where we're finding characters by the end of this episode as well.
Not to mention the fact that not just Deep Space Nine, but by the end of the season 6, he's talking about Bajor being his home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was interesting because he's literally telling Admiral Ross, like, I'm going to build a home, like, on Bajor.
And he pauses when Admiral Ross is, like, either a Starfleet officer or the emissary, and he has to, like, now eventually obviously goes Starfleet officer, but that is a massive transformation for this character from the very very beginning.
Yeah,
it's funny you mentioned him saying he wants to, you know, build a home on Bajor. That was a last minute addition. They needed to pad out the episode a little more, and so they threw that in.
But, really? But it's amazing.
It's brilliant.
It's how we like remember the episode, yes. though. Yeah. And but okay. But talking about his duties, you know, I think it's also a brilliant moment in that you know, Ross is like, well, what happens if you get reassigned somewhere else? I'll go where Starfleet tells me. But when I go home, I'm going to Bajor. Mm-hmm. You know, and I love those kinds of moments that they have strewn throughout this entire arc, where it's not just story beat, action beat, plus action beat. Mm-hmm. It's all intertwined with all the character stuff.
But I guess my question is, I mean, is Bajor his home because he's the emissary? Because he doesn't spend a lot of time on Bajor.
Yeah, we don't see him.
Does he have a spot on the lake somewhere that we don't know about?
He saw Vedic Bryle's gardens. He knows what's up.
Okay, well, so no. One pamphlet. You
know? I think he's by the end of the series, he's spending eternity in Bajor's fire caves. Yeah. So
I hear it's nice.
Yeah. He and Dakota are just hanging out.
Yeah. Margaritas by the fire lake.
But you know, to me, that moment did jump out in that, like, huh, like, we don't see Ben on Bajor that often. He does bring back, I remember in season 3, Explorers, he brings back the plans for the ancient Bajoran spacecraft.
Right, and, that he builds with Jake, yeah.
Yeah, so we do know that he does make visits to Bajor, you know, mm-hmm. but this is the first moment where I think he realizes, you know what, I've planted my flag here for 5 years. I forget if Cassidy's still in jail at this point, but he's got relationships going on here. Yeah. You know, this is his life, and I get that. And I think, you know, part of the brilliance of this arc, of course.
I don't know that there's that much left on Earth for him.
He's got his dad and his sister.
His dad in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And, yeah,
which he does go back to in the end.
Yeah. He shucks a lot of oysters in the season
peels
6 finale.
Was he shucking oysters in that? I thought he was peeling potatoes.
Yeah, you're probably right. I forget exactly what he was doing. But that's the whole point. I couldn't see exactly what he was doing in this bucket. It was just like, okay.
We need HD for that reason alone.
4K, man. Yeah.
But, you know, Call to Arms is also an episode that, you know, we do get the attack on the station with all these enemy ships coming in and just pummeling DS9. DS9 is firing back, and they are invaded. This is one of the most epic moments mm-hmm. in Deep Space Nine up until this point. Yep. You know, watching it 20 years later, how did you guys feel seeing that sequence again?
Okay, I was very worried that maybe 20 years later the production values would not hold up.
Right.
And I have to say, I was actually genuinely impressed by how well we're seeing. Look, you can see the seams a little bit with some of the stuff. Like, every time there's an explosion, a ship will just disappear and just turn into a fireball. There's no debris or anything like that. But I was actually very, very much impressed by kind of the visuals, just a lot of the shots. You could tell that the VFX guys were having a blast doing this, but
no pun intended.
No pun intended. What did you make of it, David?
I really enjoyed the battle scenes. I remember when I first watched them as a younger man, I was blown away by it. Just to mm-hmm. see the scale of battle in Star Trek, it was unprecedented.
Yeah, the closest we ever saw before that was Way of the Warrior. Yeah.
Right.
But this was like to kind of the nth degree to a certain degree.
And the speed of it too, you know, the DS9 guns are whipping around and firing, like, you know, they just couldn't do that in the earlier days of, say, TNG or whatever. Like, when the ships were battling, they tended to go slower, and a lot of times Star Trek would say, well, we're more naval battle, Star Wars is more aerial battle. But at this point, they could say, okay, look, we just couldn't do it at the time. Yeah. Now we can actually make these ships move quickly and have it still be coherent to the eye. And I think so much of the excitement comes from that, because a lot of time when you have extended battles in space or whatever, you kind of lose me because I'm not watching characters, I'm watching ships, you know, and I don't have any emotional attachment to them. Right. But I think what works especially in this one is the fact that we know that all of our characters are on this DS9 station, and so it's one entity we're watching get attacked, and so we can immediately recognize, make the, you know, the emotional connection between the station and the characters inside.
Absolutely. Cam, watching it maybe 5 years ago for the first time, I mean, for me, like, I was watching it back in the 90s, so I don't know how much my, you know, nostalgia bias is maybe playing into it, but how did you react watching, maybe, let's just talk about the aesthetics of, like, a space battle. Did it look a little cheesy to you, or were you able to go with it, or what?
Well, I mean, it looked like TV.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't look like a motion picture.
Yeah.
But it also looked incredibly far beyond what I had seen in earlier Trek.
Yeah.
It did not look like...
It didn't look chintzy.
No, like it looked kind of born out of that generation that we would see, you know, sort of the space battles of like the Star Wars prequels.
Okay.
Where, you know, just the advancements in what they could do in space battles was taking hold, or Independence Day even.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I really love the sequence, and ultimately it leads to the station being invaded, which gives maybe the even more badass moments of the episode.
Yeah. Dave, were you watching this, you know, in the 1990s, like week to week as it played out, or was this a little more of a later find for you?
No, this was definitely a week to week one. Especially DS9 for a brief period was a bit of a kind of like, oh, we never really knew if, you know, me and my father would watch it or whatever. And I never really knew if I was going to watch week to week, but definitely, first of all, Worf was a big puller in for me.
Sure.
His incorporation into the team or the crew was a major factor. And Worf's character in all of DS9 is so profound. I loved his entire character arc for the series. And that plays a big part in this. And then just to see a full-blown war, and as a kid who was always interested in the military history stuff, to finally see all the big races
mm-hmm.
of the Quadrant having to be brought in, well, you know, until the Romulans get brought in. But still, like, you know, you're seeing Klingons and the Federation, and you're seeing Cardassians, and it was a pretty memorable moment. It still stands, you know, and this is why I was bugging Cam all the time, it still stands as one of the most sort of outstanding arcs of the series, of any series.
Like, I literally do remember the first time that I watched it. And I just the background behind it, I remember I'd watched Scorpion Part 1 earlier that week. It was the Voyager season 3 finale. And I was like, oh yeah, DS9 is going to be on Saturday. I'll probably watch the finale. You know, that was my, you know, it was a different era. I was like, maybe I'll at least have the VCR running to... I think I had somewhere else or something else going on or something like that. And then I went on the message boards and to see people commenting on Scorpion, and somebody just commented, because this is syndication, so he actually saw DS9 earlier in the week than I was going to be able to watch it. And he's like, no, DS9, that's how you do a finale. And I watched it, and I was so utterly blown away compared with what I saw from Scorpion. So to me, it was worth kind of the buildup that we had seen over 5 years. Guys, is this kind of the, finally seeing like these open hostilities, was this the kind of payoff that you're looking for, hoping for?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I watched this episode, I watched it with no hype. I really didn't know anything. I knew that, you know, you had told me there was, you know, a big arc that was going to be really cool. But I watched the episode. I enjoyed the episode a lot throughout. But I remember when we get to that end where, you know, Kira is like frying the entire, you know, bridge. And the control room, and then, you know, we see Sisko taking off and Dukat holding up that baseball.
Oh, what a scene.
And, you know, we get that shot of Sisko rejoining the fleet. And I was just like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, you know, it's funny, even revisiting it, I don't know if the episode is as great as the ending of the episode. I think, you know, as we get into the arc, it definitely hits the same heights as the ending of this episode. But the episode itself, I feel like the ending is what leaves you just like, oh my God.
When he rejoins the fleet, and that is a moment that still stands out even from the first time I watched it. I can remember being like goosebumped because of that moment. I was like, and you see the Enterprise sitting there, right? And you're like, and you're just jacked up. You're ready to go. And
what was the last moment confusing to either of you guys? Because I remember watching at the time, and we see the Rotaran and the Defiant hit the fleet, and they turn in this direction where I thought they were going right back to Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Okay, well, what did you have any reaction like that, or did you figure that, hey, Starfleet's on the move, there's going to be some battle somewhere? What were your thoughts, David?
I definitely thought that they were coming back next season, by the way.
And I was reading my Deep Space Nine companion before we hit the record button here, and the producers of the show admitted, like, yeah, we did sign off on the VFX shot. They totally pulled off a great shot. We should have been a little bit more careful because it gave a lot of people kind of the wrong impression. So we had to actually backtrack a little bit in the premiere and just show that the Defiant had been through a lot of battles.
And to that I say, who cares?
Sure, I know. It was an amazing moment.
Yeah. Is so amazing.
So amazing.
You know, and I never felt ripped off when I get to the next episode of Time to Stand. I never, when I'm watching that episode, I was never like, whoa, hold on. You know, it was like, oh, who cares? This is awesome.
Absolutely. And because the fact that when the way they set up the next episode, it was like there's this ongoing struggle and they're not winning. And that's the most amazing part about it.
Not only that, but like mentally, you know, 3 months have gone by since, you know, they've been lost DS9. For all I know in my head, they did go right back to Deep Space Nine. They got beaten back and retreated. You know, like the fleet didn't make it. So like, it's like, it doesn't matter ultimately.
So perfect time to segue to A Time to Stand. This, of course, is the episode where they take that captured Jem'Hadar ship from the episode The Ship, take it behind enemy lines to destroy Ketchasol White facility. Meanwhile, on Tarak Nor, Kira and Odo, they got to get used to the new order of things here, which is kind of a fascinating journey. We're still in the beginning of this DS9 Dominion War invasion arc here. Guys, I have to say, I as much as I love them jumping onto kind of the Jem'Hadar ship, going behind enemy lines, I find myself more drawn into what was going on the space station. Yep. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, kind of how they've separated the crew members, and if maybe inherently the station itself provides kind of ground for like more drama, conflict, just inherently. What are your overall thoughts, guys?
One of the things that really stood out for me in this episode and the one that followed was the issue of, and I mentioned this in the opening, but collaborationist and resistor. And one of the interesting things when the season begins with DS9 being Tarak Nor is this idea of who is Odo working for now? Right. Who is Kira working for now? And they show these great scenes, and I'm blanking. Is it either the first episode or the second episode of the season where the opening scene is her going through her daily routine? She gets her coffee from the Cardassian.
That's episode two.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, but third episode.
Third episode.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. Rocks and Shoals, yeah.
Sorry, but I'm jumping ahead a little bit. But there is this like sense of they start to get into their routine.
Right.
And that routine is actually not in a way they mean to, but it's kind of supporting the enemy.
Well, even in this episode, in episode two, we have Quark saying, you know, this occupation isn't really that bad. You know, when the Cardassians had the station before, it was far worse. You know, you don't see slaves around now. And so it does sort of support the idea, you know, at least initially, that, you know what? The Dominion are, they're maybe not as good as the Federation, but they're not horrible, which is a really interesting tack to take because, you know, if you're telling a dramatic story, you initially want to make the villains really awful. But by saying, no, they're just bland, I think that's an interesting tack to take. It's more that they're oppressive, and that's the problem, at least at this point.
Yeah, well, with Jake questioning Weyoun about getting his dispatches off to Starfleet.
A great sequence.
Great stuff.
And Weyoun's like, well, are you so naive when like Jake's talking about the freedom of the press and everything like that? And I'm not going to write propaganda for you, Weyoun. I'd never think of such a thing. Weyoun is so great as kind of the administrator here.
Boy, I got to say, Weyoun has to be one of the best characters, period, in the canon. He nails it. I love every scene with him. I love his voice, his inflections. The actor nailed that character.
But to your broader point, Cam, about maybe the insidiousness of the Dominion, where like the Cardassians are overtly kind of like totalitarian, whereas I think the Dominion brilliance here is they are oppressive, they are authoritarian, but they put a nicer polish
on it.
They
do, because, you know, we have a scene in this where, you know, Dukat, like, confronts Kira, and it's creepy and awful. But, like, Weyoun is much more diplomatic. At least you could see yourself walking away from a conversation with Weyoun being like, okay, you know, at least he seemed friendly enough.
And that's what's uncomfortable about
it,
right?
That's
the beauty of it, is that that's the whole problem, is that the oppressor is friendly.
Yes.
The oppressor seems like he makes a decent argument. The occupier, the oppressor, suddenly you find yourself doing favors for him because the oppressor occupier makes that argument. And then meanwhile, as it goes on, one favor to another, to your daily routine, and before you know it, you're working for the occupier or the oppressor.
And I think that a Dominion learn this over time, that this is a much easier method than what the Cardassians essentially
employ. There was no question that the Dominion are experts at occupying and controlling sectors of a quadrant. I mean, the Cardassians are bulls in a china shop, and there's Weyoun deftly, diplomatically being able to coerce people into doing stuff, which is the mark of an experienced occupier.
I love that moment too, where, you know, Kira wants the Bajoran guards to have, you know, weapons. And Dukat's like, oh, no, no, no. But, like, Weyoun's the guy who's kind of like, well, maybe this isn't a terrible idea. You know, he's the one who's kind of like, well, you know what? Let's just let it go for now. We'll get back to this, though. Like, Weyoun is he's just the worst, because you could see how frustrating he would be, because you would walk away being like, I think that went well.
Yeah. Well, I think this is kind of a good way in order to integrate kind of the what's Odo up to here, and that's Odo, of course, is a god to Weyoun. So
and to me.
And that Rene and Bergeron, I tell you, Cam, you and I were just tickled pink, I think, last year when we're just standing around this merchant booth and we're getting pats on the back and we didn't know what was going on. And is Rene and Bergeron just patting us on the back? Yeah. And we're like, wow, what a nice guy.
I was like, Weyoun, I had the vapors.
But look, they want Odo on this ruling council, and there's the debate going on between, say, the likes of Jake, Kira, Odo. Are they legitimizing Dominion rule aboard the space station if you have a member of the Bajoran militia sitting on this ruling council? Which I think is a very, very interesting argument to make. And honestly, I think it's totally valid in that I think it is legitimizing the occupation that's going on here.
No, you know, I agree.
Again, like this speaks to the layers, and this goes back to, you know, in my opinion, without knowing what the writers were reading, it seems like some of them are familiar with the history of occupation. I mean, a lot of this speaks to me about France when Germany had occupied France in 1940 till 44. A lot of this is very similar. These issues is, you know, who is resisting? Who is collaborating? What does that mean? If you're on the council, but you're also on the resistance council, are you part of it? Are you not? Is it an issue? There was just so many historical parallels during this part and during these sort of first couple of episodes of season six that it really was, I think, one of the most interesting and layered aspects of the entire arc.
So would you say it's an accurate comparison? Sisko is De Gaulle and Odo is the Marshal, Pétain?
Yeah.
Odo's
not Pétain, but Sisko's definitely De Gaulle. There's no question about that. Because I mean, just like De Gaulle in his tank, there's Sisko in the Defiant riding back to liberate the place. But Odo doesn't go that far, because at the end, after he gets laid a little bit by the other changeling, he finally decides to switch over. But boy, sex will do wonders for a man, doesn't it?
Well, bad sex, obviously.
But this is really the start of where we see like Odo at his most impotent. Because,
well,
you know,
Cam, that's a real like clunky segue. Man, there.
No, two good puns here.
Because, you know, he very much is as we go into this seven parter, where, you know, we know he is in love with Kira. It's not working out. He's just frustrated. And he just doesn't know where to go. And as this, you know, this invasion is taken over, he still doesn't know what he's doing. And that continues through this seven-part story of just an Odo who's, I think, more like impotent as a character than any other point in the series. He's just like almost removed from it because he's like unable to take action in any way.
I think that really presents itself maybe by the time we get to Behind the Lines.
Yeah.
You know, and we can dive into it a little deeper there. Just in the interest of keeping things humming, why don't we jump over to what's going on aboard this Jem'Hadar ship?
There's one note I want to make, actually. Absolutely. So it's just the bombing of the Ketracel White facility, which, you know, as a scene, it's fine. But I thought, like, you know, Tyler, we talked about in Purgatory's Shadow and by Inferno's Light, the two-parter recently on the podcast, and there's a sequence in that where they stop, you know, imposter Bashir, and I complained that sequence, you know, was not very well staged. But compare that to the sequence here where they're bombing the station and they feel like they're gonna be locked into that force field. Like, there's so much tension in this sequence by comparison, at least for me.
I would definitely say it has a lot to do with the directing. I'm blanking on who directed this episode, but it was
Alan Croker.
Okay, and I think that was a better directed sequence than what we saw with the supernova sequence by Inferno's Light?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you think of what was going on aboard this Jem'Hadar ship that was behind enemy lines and they had to bomb the Ketracel White?
Well, my big thing with this is I love the whole Ketracel White as a strategic target. Mm-hmm. So this is the military history brain coming out now.
And listeners don't realize this, but David actually has like a tube in his neck that just in an ode to
The Ketracel White.
Yeah, coming. It's pumping right now.
It's just beer, but I think it's a, first of all, I think it's a fantastic sort of character flaw. Mm-hmm. To put in the Jem'Hadar, these seemingly invincible Jem'Hadar, and it makes for amazing plot lines in numerous different stories throughout the series. But I love it as this strategic target, and I think it's just such a fascinating idea of targeting this sort of super soldier and taking away what is obviously a reference to an addictive substance, and this sort of on one hand, making them superhuman, but on the other hand, if it's taken from them, making them uncontrollable, making them almost beasts. And it to me, that was, in the broader sense, a really cool strategic target.
I do like the strategy that Starfleet wants to employ here, but my criticism is we didn't really get to see this come to fruition throughout the run of the Dominion War. I always thought there was going to be, and we see this in other episodes like One Little Ship, where there's tension between the Jem'Hadar bred in the Gamma Quadrant versus the Jem'Hadar bred in the Alpha Quadrant. I always kind of thought there was going to be something coming, you know, to end the war that came from maybe some sort of those tensions, but that didn't really manifest itself.
Which is surprising, actually, because they certainly hinted at it on multiple different occasions that it made the most sense that there would be sort of a collapse of the Jem'Hadar command order, command structure, command and control.
You take away that Ketracel White, what does the Dominion really have? You know, like that order that is so important to the Dominion, it's lost, essentially. And I think that was a bit of a missed opportunity. And
I totally agree.
So look, I thought the ship stuff was interesting. I like Garak wearing the headgear because it gives the other characters headaches. But essentially this bombing sequence ends not so well for our faithful crew here. And,
they're hurled 17 years away.
Yeah.
And, which I kind of rolled my eyes at. I'm like, sure. That's going to pay off well.
Well, they've got no warp drive, so they're just adrift. So when we follow up with them in Rocks and Shoals, interesting. This is the third episode produced of the season, but the second one to air. So I was on my DVDs and I almost clicked on Sons and Daughters because that was the second one produced. And I had to pause and think back to my own memory banks and realize, no, this doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So why don't we jump into Rocks and Shoals? Guys, I'll say this. This might be my favorite kind of like war episode of this arc here. You know, like there's moments that I love throughout other episodes, but I think from front to back, this might be the most consistent episode that we have in this Dominion War arc.
I completely agree with you. One of my favorites of the whole war arc.
Okay. That's interesting. Cam, what's your take on Rocks and Shoals here?
It's interesting. I enjoy it, but to me, it's not as, it didn't grab me as much as some of the others in the arc.
Okay. Well, for those who may not remember, essentially the crew, their Jem'Hadar ship crash lands on this desolate planet.
It felt very Planet of the Apes to me.
Sure. And the only other people left on this planet
are apes.
and the Statue of Liberty. Yeah. So it's the remaining crew of this Jem'Hadar ship plus Avorta and about 8 or 9 Jem'Hadar soldiers. And the soldiers are running low on Ketracel White.
Right.
And the Avorta knows this. And it's just fascinating to watch the back and forth between... essentially, this is kind of the in-the-trenches sort of war story that we get here.
It was based on a World War II movie, the 1965 Frank Sinatra movie. What is it called? None But the Brave.
Yeah.
And get so, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, you can check it out. It's cool. It's Americans and Japanese stuck on a island together.
And who's doing the Ketracel White in that situation, Cam?
I can only guess. I haven't seen it. But it's worth checking out, I guess.
Yeah. So I think this works... It's addressing why war is a pretty crappy thing overall, in that Sisko is doing everything he can to give the Jem'Hadar an out here. They're like, we don't need to kill you guys. You guys have been ordered into a trap. And the Jem'Hadar is smart enough to actually recognize that.
That's great.
Which is brilliant. And he's like, yeah, I suspected so. You've confirmed it, but that is the order of things. Sisko's like... You want to give up your life? He's like, it was never my life in the first place. And I just, there's so much brilliance just oozing out of this. What do you guys think of an odious sort of character like Keevan, the Vorta?
He's such a bastard.
he would have been a great guy to have hanging around Weyoun one of those days.
You gotta love the scene where he comes walking after they're killed, and it's just him in the suitcase.
Yeah.
That is like something out of a Western, isn't it? Like,
you almost expect Sisko to just like shoot him down.
Even watching it for like probably the third time in my life, I still thought he might just shoot him down.
I mean, what I really liked is that they added a lot of dimension to the Jem'Hadar in this episode, which I think is invaluable because a lot of times when you add a species like this, they can become cannon fodder where you don't really care about them.
Right.
And a lot of time we don't even see them. We're seeing ships. But in this case, we get to see what drives them and how they can be exploited in a way that is really, you know, you look at how Keevan screws them over, and they know they've been screwed over, but it's built into their DNA to behave this way. And so you can see that, like, even though they know they're being taken advantage of, there's nothing they can do about it. So it makes them a little more sympathetic as a species, because these guys are helpless against manipulators like, you know, the Vorta.
If you've been bred from birth, I mean, there's something much more insidious. There's something much more manipulative going on. If you're a species that is bred from whatever their birth is, whatever their children, I don't think they have children, right? I think they've said that before.
Yeah, there's that baby Geminar that showed up in that episode where he finds Odo as his mentor, and the kid just grows in the course of 24 hours from infant to teenager. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, this is also fascinating that I think it helped humanize the Geminar. We're essentially watching this episode from the perspective of the character known as the Third, and he's trying to keep his troops in line. Kievan wants to know, you know, who disobeyed my orders, and the Third is like, these guys, they answer to me. I will deal with it. That is the order of things. That's the end of the conversation. And Kievan, he knows he can't really go from there. I just love how it seems as if the Geminar actually do have a sense of reason, a sense of logic. As long as they understand the order of things, they might be killing machines, but I think this may have been the best episode when it comes to humanizing these enemies that seem like kind of monsters. That's how people must know them, as monsters on the other side of the war, the Federation Klingon Alliance side as well.
I definitely agree with that, yeah, because, you know, again, they could have been disposable enemies, like, say, the alien invaders in the Avengers movie, right? Like, where it's just I don't know who those guys were. The Chitauri, like, who cares? They're just cannon fodder. But in this case, we get to see what serialized TV can do that a movie can't. You know, that we care about these invading aliens.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, guys, talking about what's going on in the space station, though, you had asked, you know, what was the episode there? Kira's getting into her routine, where we see this in Rocks and Shoals. She's literally nodding her head. She's getting cups of coffee from, you know, one of the Glins aboard Ops. She is fully immersed in this routine, and she comes to a certain point where she's pushing back against one of the Vedics who wants to resist this influence.
Right.
And Kira's like, I used to hate people like me, which I think is brilliant. You know, she goes from like this young gun freedom fighter to the man. She's part of the system in you know, somebody who's in her late 30s, early 40s by this point. Guys, Kira having her own internal conflict going on. I just love where we can go from this character from season one and see what her, you know, journey is at this point as well.
And you have that shocking moment too, which really is just like a slap in the face for her when this Vedic leaps off the promenade and hangs herself screaming, it's all for you, Damien.
Wow, Cam, that's dark. I'll say this, this is one of the more, like, the Vedic suicide was probably one of the more artistic
it's like a definite haunting
shots we've ever
moment.
Seen in, like, Star Trek. I think Mike Viger directed this one, I may be mistaken.
That is correct.
Okay, but it did stand out to me. Like, I don't usually expect these kind of artsy-fartsy sort of shots, but I think they realized, if we're going to depict somebody kind of, you know, maybe like that monk resisting the Vietnam War, with
self-immolation
there. You know, this is going to have to be a moment that's given, I think, respect, not just kind of like a master shot, a close-up, and then back to the master.
Well, not only that, but, you know, we're seeing in this case, I made a joke about the Omen earlier, but, you know, that's a nanny in this case who's been possessed. But in this case, Kira is seeing a Vedic do it. And, you know, the Vedics are these spiritual leaders who give hope to people like Kira. So she's seeing basically hope die in front of her.
Yeah.
And she's deeply religious.
Exactly. And so, you know, you can understand how this just shakes her to her core and why, you know, the resistance is born in this episode.
And sorry, Cam. Again, this speaks to this collaborator-resistor paradigm, which is one of the things that really stood out in this arc, this series arc for me, is this idea of, you know, how far do you go before you come back? And can you come back from certain can you come back if you've gone too far? And knowing Kira's background, knowing her experiences under the initial Cardassian occupation, which is super fascinating in a historical context, obviously with Germany's occupation, Germany's concentration camps and things like that, which they allude to time and time and time again in DS9. You know, Kira has the Holocaust sitting on her shoulders.
Yeah, right.
And then the Nazis have returned. And now she's working with them.
And her initial reaction is like, work within the system until she realizes, like, what am I doing here? Like, I think it's kind of the internal conflict going on here that I love more than anything else. I think really, maybe when we get to the end, I can spell this out more articulately, but I think this might, this Dominion War arc that we're watching right here, these seven episodes, it might almost be Kira's story to a certain degree.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
More
yeah.
so than some of the other characters. I think she
I
has...
think it means the most to her
yeah.
of any character.
Well, this is kind of like her redux, essentially, yeah. Of like the previous occupation. She's enduring another occupation. How does she change things or behave differently this go around? Mm-hmm. And maybe she realizes she needs a bit of a lighter touch this go around, but it's fascinating to see how it unfolds in the coming episodes. So guys, we're kind of around the middle part of this arc. Why don't we jump into the direct middle, episode four of the seven episode arc, Sons and Daughters.
The episode that really, I think, is the most impactful to the series, because we find out that Xiao has been accepted into the Cardassian Art Institute.
I know that was the highlight for you, Cam. yeah.
Her drawings are sublime.
Oh, Wei Yun is the best. Is this any good?
I bet the Vorta actually really are good at aesthetics. He just claimed that they're not because he yeah. thought like ZL was crap. But
I would totally watch a show of like the Vorta art critic.
And for those who may not remember, this is the episode where Alexander re-enters Worf's life on the Rotaran. And Zial returns to the space station at Dukat's behest. Dukat's been having a lot of problems with Kira, and I think he has the idea that, like, oh, why don't I get, like, her semi-adopted daughter here, and maybe I can worm my way into her life that way.
It's so creepy, because we saw in A Time to Stand that, you know, Dukat still has, like, some sort of, like, a very unsettling romantic design on Kira. And yes. I think it has more to do with just trying to conquer, essentially, the foe who will not allow themselves to be conquered. I think it's all narcissistic for Dukat. But we see
I don't know if that language, like, conquer is exactly what we want to...
Maybe not, no. Yeah. But Cam, I mean, in a spiritual sense.
Cam is speaking to a legitimate aspect of wartime, which is yeah. the idea of males physically conquering female bodies. This is an aspect of the darkest side of war.
And we would see this paid off later in the road with Kira's mother, too.
Gul Dukat's attempt to physically sexually conquer Kira is consistent with patterns of males in wartime
I think that's
over female populations.
Legitimate there. Like, let's talk about what it is. Like, it's attempted rape, like, on mm-hmm. Dukat's part. And yep. it is so vile and creepy throughout all this. I can appreciate how much Kira's just like, what the F do you think is going to happen here? Like, yeah. do you honestly think I'm going to fall under your spell? Mm-hmm. What are you thinking? And he goes to just the most, like, rapey sort of methods possible. It's yeah. like, oh, I'll bring on my daughter, who I know you love.
Well, that's the thing. You know, this episode is kind of goofy. Like, I think we can admit it's not a great episode.
I think it's super goofy.
Yeah. You know, the Rozhenko stuff.
That doesn't work. No. This is the episode I was legit bored watching. Like,
but if you look at the core of this Kira story with him using Xial to, you know, try and win her over through Xiao's art and all this sort of stuff, on the face of it, it's very it's not the most compelling. But you look at how he's trying to manipulate Kira and the incredibly unsettling dark undertones to mm-hmm. his behavior. That's what makes this episode even more, maybe more of a weird misfire, mm-hmm. is because the episode itself doesn't feel like it carries the weight that is required.
But you know what's interesting to me, and you were just saying that a lot of this arc is about Kira's storyline. This episode cements Dukat as the other character that this arc is about. This whole arc is about Kira and Dukat. They are the two characters, Sisko to a third, and then Worf Jadzia from there. But those are the top two characters that I think are explored the most and developed the most and are sort of given, we are really given an insight to. And this episode nails it for Dukat.
If we maybe reverse engineer Dukat's fate a little bit here, was bringing Zial onto the station like his ultimate kind of doom here, in that his pursuit of Kira was so persistent that he brings on his daughter, whose death eventually leads to his own mental health issues?
I would say so, because Zial is basically his physical vulnerability presented. Yeah. Like, you know, we know that Dukat is completely, you know, his biggest issue is his narcissism. That is what will take him down every time. Yeah. But when it's very hard to target someone's narcissism. Like, you know, you can't aim a phaser at narcissism. But someone like Zial, they know that if you get someone like a Zial, that could break him. And she's now walking around the station in the middle of a war zone. And so that is the thing, like this, you know, this twig that can be stepped on at any time and break this man. But he's too narcissistic to get her off the station because he is so busy trying to use her against Kira.
Can we maybe address the Zial problem as well? If you,
what are you talking about?
Well, okay. If you read the companion, the writers were explaining how they wanted to kill off like a notable character by the end of this arc. And further on, we have the episode Sacrifice of Angels.
Yeah.
And they figured, you know what, why don't we do it with Dekat's, you know, you never expect the villain's daughter to be the victim here. So why don't we make her into, and they use the word puppy dog, because like nobody likes it when the puppy dog is hurt in anything. And we see that in, say, John Wick, for example.
Right.
So they turn this character into essentially kind of this, I think it's a very thankless character. She seems so incredibly naive.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Her naivete is stupid to me. It's beyond.
The fact of the matter is that they had recast Zial. This is the third actress to play Zial. She clearly was of importance to the writers, but they could never get a strong grasp on what this character was supposed to be. And I think this really shows throughout the remainder of this arc here.
I think the problem is that they age her up too much. I think if you play her more as like a high school student, you might believe it more. But the issue is, you know, they cast Melanie Smith, who I think does a good job with what she's given.
Yeah.
But she looks like a grown woman. And so we're watching a grown woman play someone who's naive to the point of being a little dim. And, you know, obviously, look, if she's a high school student, that whole thing with Garrick would have been real creepy, even more so than it already is. But
although, didn't you and I figure out during one of the two-parters that Garrick is actually much younger than Andrew Robinson, the actor, which is just a weird thing. Go on.
But, you know, I mean, so obviously that is the issue. But I do think when you have a woman who was in her, I don't know, late 20s, early 30s, probably at this point.
Yeah,
I
just see.
Well, the actress or the character?
The actress.
Okay, yeah.
You know, playing this character, we're looking at her as mature.
Is the character supposed to be a high school character or like a teenage character?
I think, okay.
If she's being accepted to an art institute, I'm going to say she's like.
It'd be an 18, 19 year old?
She was in university. Like, she was a university on Bajor. So let's say she's.
We don't know what the ages work with Cardassian. Yeah. You know,
right, we
school
don't.
Ages,
that's what I was wondering.
But she's. Is still an old adolescent.
Right.
I think that's a good way to describe her.
She definitely just seems from a human perspective. she seems too old to be this naive, and that bothers me the whole time she's on the screen. It's like, come on, you know this is stupid. You know this doesn't make any sense.
Although it led to one of my favorite moments of this entire episode, where Kira's trying to talk some sense to Zial. Like, last time your father and you interacted, he left you to die in the station, and Zial says, he admits he overreacted. Overreacted? He tried to kill you.
That's the only thing that kind of lets it slip by a little bit is the fact we know her upbringing was so, like, so
grew up
awful.
In a prison, and a Breen prison camp.
So she could just be a complete arrested adolescent.
Yeah.
And you could go even deeper to, you know, be classic abused by parent syndrome or psychosis where you continually go back to the parent over and over again, even though they've abused you their entire life. So you could go even deeper with that sort of.
If we want to psych 101 or a little bit too much, oftentimes if you're in it like an abusive parental relationship, you find yourself attracted to people that are abusive.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to think that's not the case with Garrick, but I always have these question marks about.
Yeah.
Well, he does have.
There's an ominous
quality. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he's menacing.
He's
Cardassian.
Very much older. Yep.
So I think some of it is her not quite fitting in, but other parts are just like weird daddy issues.
I think the issue, too, is you got to look at with Zial is, you know, these are very like dark readings on this character. Does the show support them?
No.
Because she's not presented as a very complex character.
So the show doesn't support this type of reading?
Well, I think the show doesn't think that deeply into all this.
You know,
I don't have any evidence that the show put too much thought into her character.
Fair enough. It just feels like there are so many layers to this arc. And, I've been here. This is my third show with you guys. And
I think it's fourth, isn't it?
Fourth, maybe fourth. Yeah.
Fifth.
It's ninth. I've been on every show.
Yeah.
But
welcome back, Ben Young.
Ben Young, my man. Ben, I love you. I have a love for you, Ben Young. I guess my thing is that there's just so many layers to this, and I have a hard time thinking that writers don't think about this stuff when they're doing it, because we've never discussed Star Trek. Now we've discussed like multiple psychological layers to this show, right? And we have yet to have ever done that. Us three sitting around a table. And the opportunities are obviously there in front of us. And like you said, your favorite moment of the show. Well, you can't tell me that writer's sitting around writing that line in. He admits he overreacted. Oh, I'm sorry. That is a shout out to parental abuse.
Okay. Yeah, actually, you know
whether
what?
Okay. Whether the writers want to admit that, there was no way they didn't sit around a table going like, this is a parental abuse moment.
Well, the writers of the episode, Bradley Thompson and David Weddle, I believe, they said...
Get them on here.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, they admitted like they were given the option of writing this one or... I think Favor the Bold or Behind the Lines. I forget which one. But anyways,
they chose poorly.
They chose this one and they said, yeah, we got issues with fathers. And so we figured,
oh, that's interesting.
So I maybe there is more self-awareness that I'm giving them credit for. I just don't think that Zial is that complex of a character though.
You don't get the sense that the show is interested in exploring her that much. You know, you look at some of the other supporting characters in this, you know, arc, like, you know, Rom or Leeta. Well, not Leeta.
Leeta.
So much.
No, no, no.
I was going to say, but Nog, you know, yeah, Nog, yeah. Rom, whatever.
Definitely.
Or Damar, even, you don't get the sense that they're as interested in Zial.
And the fact that we're bringing up how problematic the character turned out to be, I think maybe that's one of the other pieces of evidence for that, too.
I think Zial matters more in terms of what she means to Dekot than what she means as a character.
Guys, she's the cannon fodder.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked about the aliens that you don't get to know. I mean, she's this sort of flat cardboard character that we've read into, but... you know, is meant to die in the end, which is too bad because realistically, you need to kill off one of the crew.
I was thinking to kill someone off.
You know,
it needs to be Jadzia now, not Jadzia later.
This was television 20 years ago. If this was produced nowadays, we'd be seeing
O'Brien would be dead. Well, Bashir would be dead.
Yeah,
somebody
big would have died. Absolutely. And I think bigger than say Nog. Nog was on the table. Garrick was on the table for like somebody that could have died.
But even Garrick to me would have been a sellout.
Yeah. To me, it doesn't seem as if that's where he seems like such a survivor. Like, does he die because a console explodes in his face on the Defiant? Like that.
To me, the cosmic joke of DS9 is that Garrick will always survive.
Yeah.
Garrick will never
die.
That's
true. That's a great running joke. Yeah, that's
one. The other big revelation that I think is worth noting here is that we find out that Dukat is a regifter. Kira sends back that dress and Dukat gives it to Zial. I was laughing pretty hard
at
that
one. And he presents it to an actress who was on Seinfeld.
Oh, that's right.
Melanie Smith is on, I think, two episodes.
Was she on the Schindler's List episode?
Yes, and she's also in the episode where they go to the Hamptons, and George gives her the lobster.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, so...
the shrinkage episode.
Yes, yes. she's the one that laughs at George, yeah.
You know what's interesting about when he regifts, though? That was actually... What's fascinating, I'm sure the writers probably... Maybe I'm overthinking it, but that was the moment where you realize that Dukat was still the insidious, you know, puppeteer.
Yeah, yeah.
Up until that point in that episode, you were like, oh, maybe he's kind of, developing some sort of sympathetic traits. And then when he takes that dress and then passes it off to his daughter as an original gift, then you're like, no, he's still the same old, puppeteer that he always has been.
I was greatly grossed out by that whole sequence because you know he picked that dress for Kira for a reason.
Of course. Yeah.
That's what Dekot likes.
And gives
it
to his daughter?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Also worth noting that... Damar, the future legate of the Cardassian Union, he's tasked with being a delivery boy in this episode. I like how there's so much social mobility within the Cardassian Union. You could go from delivery boy to legate over the course of about four episodes, which
true.
Is fantastic to me.
Not one Cardassian on DS9 could deliver that except for Damar.
of the Worf Alexander stuff, the only thing I really want to mention is that I thought Martok was really great this episode.
Yes, that was in my notes.
That scene was so good.
Martok proves why he's a great leader and a great mentor and why Worf is a crappy father.
Yeah.
Like we've talked about before, Worf is a bad dad.
Yeah.
And like it is one of his character's flaws, and I don't think they comment on it enough, but he is a legit bad father where he's kind of given up on his son. You wonder why maybe Alexander disappoints Worf. I think a lot of it has to do with Worf's parenting skills at this. And Martok trying to give Worf advice, trying to give Alexander some advice. I thought that was just, it showed why Martok's such a great character, though.
It was a great character moment in an episode that, you know, isn't the best for the Klingon stuff.
No, and Alexander's ridiculous. I mean, it's just, it's this buffoonery that you can see. It makes Worf uncomfortable, makes all of us uncomfortable when we're watching it. You feel bad for the kid.
I mean, you know, and it is wartime. This, if he's this incompetent, he should be on, like, he should be a cargo ship, cargo ship or a janitor somewhere. Like, yeah, it just make, you know, look, people's
lives. Why is he on the weapons console?
People's lives depend on this guy.
Yeah, how do you get posted as a recruit to a ship and you're, like, right on the bridge? I don't understand. How do you move up the ranks? Are that many people dying?
And he's on the general's ship. This isn't, like, a commander's ship. Like, this is one of the probably lead ships in, like, whatever fleet that they're in. I'm, like... I didn't get it.
No, it's just, it's dopey.
Yeah, to me, this is, I think this is the weak, this is the weakest point of the entire Dominion War arc that we're talking about.
Well, you know, when we look at this as an arc, like, this is the lone episode I felt like if you, removing the Kira Dukat stuff, this could just be a random episode throughout the series. You know, you could have an episode where there's a ship that, you know, Alexander's on.
And it's, it would have been better in that. It would have been better in a non-wartime. Here's this goofy kid, gets his chance on the bridge, goofs it up, warp has to sort of deal with the fact that he's not a good dad. Yeah. And that's that.
Yeah. Okay, guys, why don't we jump over to Behind the Lines? This is where the female changeling returns to Deep Space Nine and starts interacting with Odo, which essentially puts this resistance effort at risk to quite the degree. I'll say this, if we're still talking about some of the challenges or things that I would have improved, it makes me feel as if Odo has lost a certain amount of agency in that he's come under the spell of the female changeling. But I don't want to, you know, kind of undersell Odo's own conflict in that he's in a profoundly lonely position.
Yeah.
And I understand why he feels more at home in this great link, which is, I think, a more profound experience than anything we could experience as solids. But I understand why he is there. But to me, it takes away something from the character where we see maybe his priorities aren't as lined up with this makeshift family that it seems everybody else has on Deep Space Nine. That maybe it can be compromised to a way that I don't think this would have ever happened to, say, Sisko or Jadzia.
Well, I mean, Odo's a profoundly broken character. Yeah. And he is broken because he's separated from his whole. You know, he's this character who's stranded, essentially. And so what we're seeing is, at this point, everything's going to hell around him. His friends are scattered. And he's just like, I have nothing. And, you know, we can see how the female changeling can really grab hold of that and exploit it and, you know, and manipulate him. And, you know, the female changeling is kind of like Wayoon, where she's so good at what she does that you're like, I can see how I could get along with her. Yeah. She seems nice. You know,
though the intimacy is really awkward.
I agree.
It just makes me cringe. It's just very odd.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me as a more seductive take on, like, the Return of the Jedi Emperor Luke thing, where, you know, he's just talking the whole time. You know, the Emperor's just, like, trying to seduce him over to the dark side. That felt a lot like this scene here with throughout, I guess, the next couple episodes.
Well,
with
I guess
the female
I know
changing.
What videotapes I can find underneath your mattress, Cameron.
Oh, my.
Seductive, is it? Yeah.
When Star Trek Gets Sexy, Part 2, coming next week, folks.
But there's moments where, like, Kira confronts Odo about this, and she has it out, and it turns out the female changeling's in the next room and says, hey, did she upset you? Odo says, no, she didn't. And I believe Odo. I don't think it's a ruse that he's playing. Like, I think he legit is not upset by it because he's so enamored by the idea of the Great Link that it's so much more important to him. And I believe it when the female changeling doesn't seem to care all that much about this idea of a resistance. She's like, those are matters that I let the Vorta deal with, you know? Guys, how come nobody anticipated the likes of one Major Kira would be behind a resistance movement aboard Deep Space Nine? Why is she not under a greater watch by the administrators here on Terraknor?
I'm willing to let that one slip by.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I agree.
Well, like, Dukat's in love with her.
That's also true. Yeah. He's blinded, in a sense. And I don't think he knows that if Kira's busted, the Jem'Hadar and the Vorta are going to have her executed. And he does not want that.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You know, I feel like he's willing to kind of let her operate on the margins just so long as she doesn't really present herself.
Yeah, but I mean, the big issue here is that I think Zial could come up and say, hey, Pops, you can't kill off Kira, right? And, you know, even if he's going to resist that notion anyways, even though we do have the prospects of Rom getting executed later on in the series.
And not to mention the fact that Ben Sisko's kid is on the... Ben Sisko is enemy and his kid is on the station.
Yeah, what do you think of Jake throughout this arc? Because I think it seems... I wish they gave Jake more to do, but I think it was just so busy. But I think he could have been getting away with so much more than what we actually see here, because he is kind of untouchable when you think about this non-aggression pact that the Bajoran Republic has signed here. Essentially, if the Dominion reneges on that, then what does that mean to the rest of the Alpha Quadrant that they're trying to influence? If they don't see that the Dominion is going to stay true, why would that not immediately make the Romulans want to join up with this Klingon Federation Alliance, or make the Tholians or the Ferengi, you know, so on and so forth? So I think Jake could have gotten away with way more than he actually did.
Well, and he is a reporter character, so you could have used him as a means of allowing us into kind of secret rooms and whatever. He could have played that sort of audience avatar.
Hmm.
But I guess they just didn't really care about him.
It sounds to me like they didn't have a space for him in the arc, and they had to fit him in, and they like wedged him into this one space and then never really put much thought into it. And considering the characters we've talked about and who have been developed over this arc, there's a lot of work going into a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Boy, you don't have a lot of space for Jake.
You know, you look at I love, you know, O'Brien, Bashir, Jadzia. Yep. You know, it's not like they are huge prominent figures in this arc either. You know, they get their business, as does Jake, and that's good.
But you learn more about those, you know, Bashir and O'Brien and Jadzia. You learn more about them in the arc than you do about Jake. Jake really.
Well, like, we do learn that he's now a member of the news service.
Yeah,
that's sort of. But that's, you know, it's something. I'll take it.
Congratulations.
What I really like about this episode is this is where we see Quark turn to being like, yes, I am fed up with these people. What I like about this is, you know, right from the start, Quark was envisioned as sort of this Casablanca Rick figure. We're seeing now, you know, where he is following the arc of Rick, where he realizes, I don't want to deal with these Nazis.
Do you guys wish that we did get to see more from Quark throughout this? Because I think he was underserved throughout this entire arc. And the moments that we did get from Quark were, I mean, like, top-tier Quark moments.
Fantastic stuff. Like, you know,
Drunk Quark.
I love that, you know, this episode is the one where Damar's pads, you know, is, you know, thanks to Rom's fast fingers, he grabs hold of Damar's pad, lets the Jem'Hadar see it, and then it causes this riot that results in death. Like, horrible things happen at Quark's
poor
bar.
Poor guy, that one Cardassian gets his back from
I
love that, like that wrestling move.
Oh, man. Right out of WWE.
Yeah, but we see how Quark is just, like, shaken. Like, he's, like, this. Like, he did not expect stuff like this to happen. And so we get to see this character who's always just kind of plays, you know, the chameleon, the guy who just blend into the background, start to get shaken by what he's seeing.
And moving forward, he does end up killing people.
Definitely,
yeah.
Which obviously has a big factor.
And what matters the most about him doing things like this is we can see it hurts him more as a character than it does Sisko or whoever else. You know, these are people who have seen battle. Quark is a civilian, essentially, who's very, like, shaken up when bad things happen in front of him.
But also think of where Quark has to go as a character, where he actually wants to get involved and resist, at least ostensibly. Like, he's not part of the resistance officially, but he is facilitating a lot of what happens here. This guy is somebody who went through that entire Cardassian occupation as a bar owner. I don't think he was getting involved with the Bajoran resistance so much there. So I like to see how shaken Quark is as a character at this particular juncture.
Yeah.
So guys, why don't we jump over to Favor the Bold? We're now in the end stretch of this Dominion invasion arc of Deep Space Nine. We've got plans to retake Deep Space Nine. People are getting sick of all this.
Question.
Yeah.
Was this too soon? Could we have done a whole season?
Well, Ira Steven
Absolutely
Bear.
Absolutely could have.
Yeah.
Ira Steven Bear said that they debated a lot about how many episodes. I think initially Rick Berman only wanted to do maybe two episodes.
Right.
Then they were like, okay, please give us five. They agreed on five. And then Ira Steven Bear said, like, okay, please just six. And Ira Steven Bear said, we could have done 10. Like,
right.
10 with us not aboard DS9 or with DS9 under Dominion control.
It is funny because my memories of this arc was that it was way longer.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes, and that I was like, oh man, we spend so much time on that station with these, you know, the resistance characters and all that. And when I saw it was only 7 episodes, I was like, really? Wow. Like, it just means to me that there's a real sense of the epic in the storytelling where in your memory, it feels like a massive event. Like it's like a great novel or something that you just feel like you live in for, you know, a period of time that is more expansive than it really is.
I'll say this. I knew going in that this was going to be six episodes because right. When that finale, that season five finale happened, I was all over the internet trying to figure out what was going to happen next. And they were very upfront. The writers were very upfront saying this is going to be like a six episode arc. We're going to resolve it over the course of very more serialized than we've ever had before on Star Trek. And So my brain, I was always programmed to experiences kind of like this six episode arc here.
Right.
But here, look, we've got the plans to retake the station. Meanwhile, that minefield, Damar's kind of figured out a way to bring it all down.
Good old Damar.
Good old Damar. Yeah. So they're trying to resist that. And Odo, still under the influence of the female changeling. She and him get it on with physical forms of intimacy, and she says, you've done this before. And Odo's like, not often. I'm just like, oh, Odo, okay. TMI, sir.
Yeah.
But
isn't her first line, though, is that, oh, so that's how solids do it.
Yeah. Yeah. But guys, I still like I just kept getting more and more drawn into what was going on this space station, and that Kim, you brought it up. O'Brien and Bashir really didn't have much to do. At least Jadzia had like the wedding plans.
Right.
What was like Bashir and O'Brien's arc throughout this?
For me, what we get really of O'Brien is we get to see him revert back to Soldier O'Brien that we've heard talked about.
Yeah.
If you know the canon of O'Brien, you get to see a little bit of that paid off, but it's not flashy. So that's what I enjoyed about it. And I think Bashir, we get to see sort of the... him, you know, when we first met Bashir, he's this young man. We get to see him in battle now and see how well he adapts. You know, he's not this like goofy guy on the. He's not Alexander Rozhenko.
Also think about like young people, how well they're adapting. We got Nog. And I think Nog might actually have more to do than, say, Bashir or O'Brien throughout this arc. We see like this young green cadet. He eventually gets promoted to ensign throughout this arc as well.
Well, technically lieutenant commander.
Well, but by the Valiant.
The Valiant crew, yeah.
Which I was like, we've discussed the Valiant episode on our Starfleet Academy show, which is not too long ago.
Yeah.
That Valiant was not one of my favorites.
Red
I'll
Squad,
say that.
Red Squad.
Red Squad, Red Squad.
We can do anything.
That moment was at least like hilarious, but but look, we see kind of the resistance going at it. They're like, oh my god, like we have to figure out you know what to do here. I do see this as really more of a setup episode for
the
finale. I was
gonna say that it's a table setting for the next
episode. So I don't think this is the strongest entry into the Dominion War arc that we're talking about here specifically.
It does include one moment though that is so badass, which is Kira beating the crap out of Damar.
Just works him.
He doesn't
even have a chance.
That was cathartic for all, not just Kira, but for the viewing audience as well. Cam, at this point with Damar, I had pumped this character up to you a lot. Yeah. And you're like, why does Tyler even like this character? Were you just mystified by how much?
This guy's a douche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know what? He's very loyal to Dukat, though. You got to admit that. Like, it's almost insanely loyal. Even when Dukat returns after going crazy, he's still like... this guy's one of the greatest men in the history of Cardassia.
Well, he's just like, I hope you're still not upset about me killing your daughters.
Yeah, like, no, he's like, no, your problem.
Yeah.
The writer said like they had him drinking a lot because they wanted to show that he was a character with a conscience. And
too bad they didn't do that. I think that would have been great.
Well, no,
he is drinking throughout this arc, but
in a way that's like looking at your glass.
No,
and like,
I never got the sense that where Damar would go is really being set up that well in this arc.
It's like they've got this kind of Dukat lackey who serves a purpose. He's a total prick.
Yeah,
I think like Casey Biggs like hits out of the ballpark with the way that he's playing this kind of character. And to watch the character go from that season four non-speaking role to this just punk, this total punk, and to a resistance hero himself, where he and Kira are literally working in the Cardassian resistance together. They go from like throwing punches at one another in this arc to like fighting side by side together, which is just, it's mind-blowing to see like a character like this. But it, definitely. This is the most that we ever get to see of Damar kind of consecutively, which is kind of fascinating, at least until we get to that 10-episode home stretch for the last few episodes of the show.
Definitely. Well, why don't we move into Sacrifice of Angels and wrap this arc up? Guys, how well does this thing end? Because, you know, this is an episode where...
Well, there's a lot of, not tying that had to go on.
Definitely.
You know, like, tying up loose threads. Not tying.
Were you enveloped by this episode, Tyler?
Yes, it was enveloping to me. Okay, let me say this. A title like Sacrifice of Angels.
Yeah.
We've kind of alluded to the sacrifice that goes on here. There were a lot of rumors throughout the summer, though, that Colm Meaney was not renewing his contract.
He was the angel?
Yes. And I was convinced that Colm Meaney was off the series. And because the people would say, like, there would be interviews with Renee Auberjonois, and they're like, oh, is Chief O'Brien getting killed off? And Auberjonois would say stuff like, I haven't really seen him at all this season. We're on different sets, shooting on different days because of the way they've... So they weren't reassuring audiences. I was convinced O'Brien was going to die.
He was the angel. That's amazing.
Well, the whole time I'm watching this, I'm just like, is he going to get an exploding console to the face at the last minute? Like,
score to that Sarah McLachlan song.
In the Heart of an Angel. Yeah. And there's like kitty cats like in the background too. Yeah. Okay. I was so anxious because I was like, O'Brien's had like almost nothing to do throughout this arc. He's going to randomly die.
Yeah.
And like, even until the last few moments of this episode, I was convinced, like, I don't know, is Damar going to come back and shoot O'Brien randomly? Like, I was so frightened as like a teenager watching this one.
Well, that didn't happen.
Didn't
Tyler.
Happen. Instead, we got Zial died. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, guys, what do you make of the conclusion of Zial, Dave?
I thought I was weak. I thought I was killing off a character that meant the least, almost probably.
Did it
the
seem
least.
Like a cop out?
Totally.
Yeah.
In every way, it felt like the writers were like, frankly, it felt like the writers weren't brave enough to kill off a top character.
I think it's kind of true in that it was a different era of television writing, and you just don't really do that unless you're Denise Crosby and you have a contract dispute, or you're Terry Farrell and you have a contract dispute. There were no contract disputes going on, so they weren't willing to do what I think had to
be nowadays
done.
They just kill you. Yeah. They don't care.
And Cam, you and I, we've discussed this. Like, we're pretty convinced that like a significant character is going to die by the end of season one of Discovery.
Definitely.
Right? Yeah.
Well, to be fair, sorry, Tasha Yar died. So, I mean, we already had a serious character die.
Yeah. Sure. Was that a great end to that character?
It was a terrible end.
Yeah.
I will get you.
Good old Armus.
You could do an entire episode of Armus impersonation. I would just laugh.
Maybe like, a commentary.
Yeah.
I know this is totally off topic, but was she in a contract dispute when they killed her off? And I know we talked about this before.
She wanted to quit. She was quitting the
show. Okay.
Yeah. Right. But with this as... Okay. Why don't I throw this hypothetical out there? Who would you guys would have killed off instead of Zial? Like, what would have made most sense thematically if we follow these characters over the course of these six episodes? Who would have been this so-called sacrifice?
I mean, honestly, to be perfectly honest, I think Zial works because of what it means to Dekot. Mm. Like, when we see what happens to Dekot, that is what pays off this entire arc for me. Like, Dekot is much the major character of this arc, and to see him just broken and shattered at the end of this is, you know, the ultimate...
But they did set it all up for that, though. Like, it was conscious on the part of the writers, but should the writers have also consciously set up another character?
Yes, that's what I was going to get to, is that I think someone else should have died as well.
It's Sacrifice of Angels... Right. Not Angel.
That's true. There should have been a balance. You know, I think you're right. The writers did set it up that Zial dies, Dukak goes crazy, but there had to be something that makes the viewer go crazy.
Like
there
had to be higher stakes than...
Yeah, yeah.
I was relieved. I was like, it's Zial who dies. It's not O'Brien.
We watch it and we're like, oh, good. Screw him. We didn't like him anyway. So there, you know, like she was nice, but we don't really get to know her. We've not spent a lot of time with her.
We're not invested.
We're not invested.
You know who would have been powerful? Rom.
Yeah, I think Rom would have been a good one.
Because we have Rom at the start of this, you know, talking about marrying Leeta. So there's that sort of audience.
Rom would have been a great one. I still think Jadzia, and she dies anyways.
The audience is invested in seeing Rom happy, as well as we're seeing throughout this. He's the one who's, you know, being a resistance member while his brother is scared.
Yeah.
And if you have Rom die at the end and leave that with Quark, I think that really shakes that character.
That's a good idea. That would have been pretty intense.
I didn't really have a good answer for you guys because the problem
was...
Thanks
for proposing it to the rest of us.
Well, no. My problem was like, well, if you go for one of the main Starfleet characters, you're not going to kill off Kira.
Yeah.
Not Odo. If you go for one of the three other, you're not killing off Sisko either.
No.
So
you could have done O'Brien.
You could have done Bashir.
You could have done Jadzia.
Yeah.
Would it have meant much though with O'Brien or Bashir?
But not
O'Brien
the way...
would have meant much because O'Brien still has the TNG carryover.
But the problem with the storytelling was that O'Brien wasn't really given a real arc throughout this, so it would have felt
weird.
It would have been a cheap death.
Yeah,
it would have been killing him.
He would have been the red shirt
him.
On the away mission.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think honestly, Kim, Rom is brilliant.
The way you put it, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll take a bow here, people.
Yeah, thank you. No, but I'm thinking just like how that would have impacted Quark throughout the remainder of the series,
That could have been a good opening for a real, like, deeper exploration of Quark's character.
Yeah. So, I mean, unfortunately, they didn't go there. Beyond that, I mean, how does this work wrapping up some of the loose threads that we have? I'm mixing metaphors a lot, tying up a lot of the loose threads that we have throughout the preceding six episodes.
I mean, to me, I think it does. Frankly, you know, we talked about how this is the first long form arc in Star Trek. I think it does a brilliant job for, you know, a first time out. Because, I mean, I think of a lot of other Star Trek firsts that maybe didn't work out quite as well. The fact that this wraps up so satisfyingly. You know, it ends with, you know, Dukat walking around like a madman, a dazed madman, carrying the baseball that Sisko had left on the desk in Call to Arms and handing it back to Sisko at the end. Just this broken man muttering.
He's defeated.
He's completely defeated.
Yep.
And to me, that is just the power of this two-parter. And what I love about it is that in many ways, we see that, especially because of war, we see more extreme versions of these characters. You can see how Sisko could be a villain and how Dukat, in a way, is like a twist away from being a hero. But they're perverted by the nature of who they are. You know, Sisko, in his sense, he has moral ideas. He's going to be a good leader to his people, and so he is the hero. And Dukat is the villain because of his own, you know, complete failings as a human being, or not a human being, but as a person. And, you know, but you could see how it could be twisted.
And, you know, the writers actually go into more detail on that later in the season when they do the episode when Sisko does the monologue to the computer when he orders the sabotage and that they try to, like, trick the Romulans.
Definitely.
In
The Pale Moonlight, which is a great episode. Oh, man, like real, like, Cold War spy stuff that they're tapping into, and there you get a sense of Sisko, like how quickly he'll go into sort of like, if someone has to die, someone has to die. If this person is expendable, it's expendable. You're absolutely right. Sisko's he's a cold-hearted dude,
you know,
man.
He is willing to like completely kill himself and his crew.
Okay, what exactly was his plan? Flying into the wormhole?
I don't really know.
He said load quantum torpedoes. Going to try to destroy the wormhole from the inside?
No, that's the only thing that bothered me about this is that they needed to establish this idea that he thought the prophets could help him.
I thought he was trying to summon them by threatening to destroy.
It's nothing like you thought he was trying to fight and kill his crew in a meaningless battle, which to me is careless and reckless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if he had been like, there was something like, I don't know how the writers could have done it, but there was some way they could have hinted that he was like, I have an idea. Just pretend you're going in to fight them. I have an idea, though. Like, leave it cliffhangery, and then they summon, you know.
He was genuinely surprised when the prophets summoned him. He's like, what the hell are you guys doing here? I'm trying to destroy shit. You know? So I was just like.
So basically, he was trying to go on a suicide mission, which actually wouldn't have helped anything, which means that at the very end there, if you really read into it, he was being stupid and reckless.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was saved by the prophets.
They'd even established before by Inferno's Light and in Purgatory's Shadow that you can't really destroy the wormhole. It's kind of impervious to like methods. Like they tried to collapse the wormhole previously.
Right.
So I don't like, he was just going to try to shoot as many Jem'Hadar ships as he could.
Well, I mean, is it just that, you know, because Dukat is the mirror image of Sisko in this series. Mm-hmm. Is it just that these are two men who have been pushed to the point of desperation and it's just that fate is on Sisko's side?
Maybe from a poetic kind of narrative.
Not from an established writing narrative. Dukat has obviously been pushed to the brink. Sisko has not been there yet.
Well, you don't think so?
No, I don't.
No,
not quite.
Not quite.
This isn't in the pale moonlight territory just
no,
yet. That's where he's at his brink, I think.
But we're seeing there is a sense of like they've lost so many ships and he's feeling the, sort of this pressure to retake Deep Space Nine. You're right. We could have seen it, dramatized more on screen.
It just seems odd that he would sacrifice the best ship in the fleet, I mean, so to speak.
Yeah.
If you're a DS9 watcher, it's the best ship in the fleet. If you watch other shows, there's another ship that's better in the fleet.
Sure.
Yeah. But it's just weird that he would just take it and sacrifice it like that. And then they have no Defiant, no Valiant. They have none of those ships anymore.
I just wonder if the issue was they just didn't know what to do. Like, literally, they had no idea what to do. They're like, we have this glory move where, you know, Sisko, backed by the, you know, the Klingon ships, bust through the defense. And okay, and then what? Yeah. You know, it's like we got him there, and
By the way, but can I just say something about the battle in terms of history sense? Could I just throw a parallel? So what's interesting about that final battle scene is I don't know if any of you guys have ever been familiar with the Battle of Waterloo.
Yeah.
Where Napoleon is defeated. And so the Duke of Wellington, wrong era.
Arthur Wellesley. Years apart.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Historian.
It's the white. I'm running out of the Tetris. So Arthur Wellesley is, you know, defending against Napoleon's charges over and over again. And Napoleon's line's about to break, or Wellesley's line, Duke of Wellington's line's about to break. And so the British and their sort of allies are about to be defeated. And then at the last second, out of the left flank, in fact, the same flank that the Klingons come from, the Prussians arrive onto the battlefield. Mm. And they crash into the French side. And they turn the tide, and they win the Battle of Waterloo. And I wonder, the military historian in me has to think to myself that these guys were thinking Waterloo when they did this, because the Klingons come out the same flank, the left flank, at the last second, and crash into the line to win the battle.
I think Thompson and Weddle might have like previously done some sort of like military history book.
Oh, interesting.
So I think it is actually like in the cards that there's some military historians on that writing staff at the time. I might be mistaken, but I that's my recollection.
Well, it certainly was echo of Waterloo.
Yeah,
and the same sort of story of Waterloo.
Can we talk about these kinds of space battles for just a second here? Do they make any sort of sense that you'd have about what was it? Just over 2,000 ships
packed together. No, it doesn't make sense.
No, it makes no sense.
And they all drop out of warp.
But on a 4:3 framing on a TV, I guess they need to kind of pack them together to make it look dense.
But just from like a strategic standpoint, like they should like all be at warp speed, trying to outrun each other, shooting warp to warp. Whether it's photon torpedoes, phasers, I don't know. It just seemed. Look, it's fantastic to watch. The visual effects were stunning in this.
Yeah.
Like 20 years later, I'm blown away. But I don't think this is how actual space battles will take place 500 years in the future.
So. I think the one thing is, too, and this is where Star Wars kind of got a little bit of it right, is that it's big ships shooting out small fighters. And the small fighters are fighting each other while the big ships lob, you know, slower moving, harder to create, energy speaking, you know, cannons or artillery shells or whatever they're firing in space, planets, plasma beams. That makes a lot more sense for what a space battle would look like.
Yeah.
You know? Not sort of large Romulan warbirds or Klingon birds of prey dipping and diving and zipping and zapping, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these are large ships.
I think, you know, 500 years in the future, if there are space battles, it's going to be large ships shooting some sort of projectile weapons across vast distances that'll be intercepted by other projectile weapons being shot by other very large ships.
Which is super boring for the
It's not exciting to watch, but I think that's far more realistic.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's going to be much more of a... It's going to be like submarine combat in the sense of, you know, more like the original series did, I think. But ultimately, this is a, you know, an arc where it's ending fever pitch.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to cut to beep, beep, beep.
Everyone is holding on.
Yeah. We're at 45 degrees. Get ready. Load torpedoes.
Brace for impact.
Miss.
That's the best. Oh, yeah. I want to be on that ship. And the guy says, like, miss. And you're just like,
reload.
But if we can bring it all back around to this, when you think about this arc in general, must it go down as one of the peaks of Star Trek storytelling the way that we think of it? Like, we have things like maybe the Best of Both Worlds arc. We've got the Dominion War arc. We've got, like, how does this kind of rank in your own brains as part of Star Trek lore at this point?
To me, this sets the stage for a lot of the Star Trek arcs that I really love, like the Zindi arc of season three of Enterprise. To me, this is, I don't think any other show has done it as well as Deep Space Nine did, mm-hmm. both with this 7 episodes as well as, you know, the 10 episodes that closes the series.
Yeah.
But man, like DS9 really set a high bar with this arc in a way that I don't even have that much faith that Star Trek Discovery will be able to touch this.
I think the problem with Star Trek Discovery, though, is I think one episode to another, it's going to be hard to discern. I'm going to be getting a lot of the episode like mixed up with each other on Star Trek Discovery, whereas there's enough episodic sort of elements going on. Like, I know that the season premiere was the one where they take the ship behind enemy lines. I know the second episode is where they crash land on a planet. Yeah. I know the third episode is where Alexander goes and meets up with Worf.
Yeah.
I don't think that serialized storytelling is going to be quite the same on Discovery, though. And I think this is actually the way that you should be doing it. And I think Enterprise really got it right when they tackled that on season 4.
Right.
Where they had like the small arcs that were all very distinct, but, you know, we'll see what happens in a few weeks.
Sense, you know, with DS9, they didn't try it until season, you know, at the end of season 5.
Right.
Going into 6. At this point, we know these characters.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to be fair, they also brought in every species in the universe.
Yeah.
Like, all the people, all the races that we had dealt with in TNG and the original and on and on and on and on. All of them are here.
And if they're not here, they're often referenced.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Know? The Romulans are sitting over there like, what are they going to do? Like, non-aggression pact, Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, non-aggression pact. Here we have the sort of Romulan, you know, I mean, this is like the tension of the entire universe is palpable. And no one will, anyone can do it if they write it right, but it's just, no one has been able to capture it like that.
And speaking of it, like, from a legacy standpoint, I can tell you at the time watching it, there had been nothing like this on television as far as Star Trek goes. I know people would argue Babylon 5 was doing this for sci-fi realm, but as far as Star Trek is concerned, I'd never seen anything on it like it previously. So I was utterly captivated and blown away, and I was like, this is how I want my Star Trek in the future. And I that really helped draw me in. I think this is the arc that actually made DS9 my favorite series over Next Gen. I think this is what really did it for me here.
What I love about it, too, is that, you know, a lot of people have talked over the years about whether Gene Roddenberry would or wouldn't have approved of what Deep Space Nine did.
Yeah.
I look at, like, this 7-episode arc as, like, one of the best tributes to, you know, people or humanity or however you want to say it, where the idea that even in the darkest of times, people will keep fighting and keep fighting because, the human race, as exemplified by the Federation, you know, metaphorically, will always push forward for a positive, you know, tomorrow. And we see that they're never broken. They will continue. And, you know, ultimately, they find it again at the end of this arc. And so, is it dark? Does it get violent? Does it get ugly? Definitely. But that spirit of hope is, you know, it never goes away.
Incoming transmission.
With us right now is Patrick Johnson, special guest. We just want to ask you a little bit about maybe this Dominion War arc, the invasion arc, you know, those 7 episodes, premiered 1997, started with the Call to Arms, concluded, and look, the Dominion War carried on, but it concluded with a sacrifice of angels. At the time, Patrick, what were your thoughts like watching Deep Space Nine and watch it have like kind of this serialized, sustained, you know, arc going on for, I guess, 6-7 episodes?
So Call to Arms ends season 5, right?
Yeah.
And then to open season 6 and to have the same sort of story. I mean, we didn't know arc was a thing. You're like, how long are they? This is awesome.
Yeah. This is TNG would never do this.
They never did this. This is great. I'm so, you know, it was great. It was a really, at the time, fantastic choice because it kept you locked in. I mean, I know the last time I was here, we talked about the fact that it was a 1 out of every 3 or 4 episodes would get watched by hardcore fans.
I mean, that's
a bold choice by them even at that point. I mean, it makes sense to us now, but that, it was awesome. It was just great. And it kept you coming back because you're like, you know, the storytelling was so vast and it was so complex and well thought out and so many interesting characters in it, and a kind of Star Trek that, you know, we'd never seen before.
Well, I'm curious. You got into the franchise through Next Generation, correct? Is Next Gen still your favorite series, or is Deep Space Nine kind of taking
that mantle? It's one of those ones. I still go to the fact that I, you know, when I sit down and if I want to watch something on Netflix, I pick TNG because I know it so well.
It's hard for DS9, too, because just to pick a random episode,
you're like, but wait, I want to follow that thread. Yeah. And am I going to be doing like a binge watch over the next course of 12 hours?
I think it's also the reruns thing, because DS9 was never in reruns the same way TNG was.
Sure. Yeah.
And so especially I think in, you know, say when I was going to university, and that was, you know, like Star Trek was on five nights a week. People forget this.
Yeah.
And TNG was on five nights a week, and often the original series was on like right after. And then there was a period, you know, where I think on, you know, on Space or whatever, you would see old DS9 episodes, but, you know, life carried on. So I didn't have it locked in kind of as on repeat the way TNG is. And so, but I've been meaning to, and I know Cam's been rewatching DS9. I've sort of slowly, I mean, I've got obviously lots going on, but I've been trying to kind of slowly pick away at it. And it was kind of neat, you know, when I was here last time to talk about Purgatory Shadow and
Inferno's Light.
By Inferno's Light.
Yeah.
You know, and to see that where the show is really rolling, and then absolutely this arc which comes after that, and that those two episodes set it up so well. There's so many things going on, and the characters are so well textured. I mean, you know, you learn about Bashir, and there's all these things being revealed to us that create this other universe that, you know, I don't know if Gene Roddenberry would have been happy with, but in terms of the actual sort
he would not have.
Right?
Yeah.
But in terms of the storytelling and the sort of, you know, the universe they've created, and it works. It's great. It was a great period to be, you know, a first-hand witness to.
Does the serialization of it, had you ever really seen anything like that before when it came to, you know, kind of the shows that you were into at the time? I guess I don't know, maybe if you're into L.A. Law or...
Big L.A. Law.
Seems... Or NYPD Blue or something like that. Like, there's more serialized television...
X-Files.
You know.
Too. Yeah.
Well, X-Files,
but it would be like two-parters and it would continue the story, but it never, never saw like seven episodes connected.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this, what I'm getting at is, was this kind of a different viewing experience? Did you have to kind of readjust, you know, the way you viewed this?
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there weren't a lot that we were watching anyway. I was an X-Files guy and you know, you'd watch The Simpsons or whatever, and that, you know, those are standalone. And, there was not, it's certainly nothing I was watching. I mean, I know there were examples of that, and I know David Simon had an early effort with Homicide at that point, and that was still, I guess, on the air at that point. But, there wasn't, certainly not in terms of, you know, I think I was probably your average TV viewer. So, you know, not, you know, didn't know the insider stuff, you know, I was a teenager, right? You weren't as aware of the industry maybe as you might be now. And, it was a very new, brash thing, and it was kind of cool. I was like, you know, I knew a lot of people didn't watch Deep Space Nine, and I was like, this is kind of cool. This is our thing. Like, this is our thing, and only Deep Space Nine fans know about it.
Patrick, maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but is there a moment or just something about that seven-episode arc that just really pops out in your own brain?
Oh, my. Well, I mean... Is it the end of Call to Arms when the Dominion takes over the station again?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And leaves the baseball.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think that might be that? Kind it's of the go-to and, image and, for most people.
And that's, I mean, Weyoun's in by this point, right? So that's Weyoun, and he's like, what the heck is that? And Dukat knows, you know, and it's that sequence is really fascinating. And some of the kind of politics that you get in there, that stands out as well. Who takes over for Dukat?
Damar,
right? So is Damar's around?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is this where Damar takes over, or is that at the end of the sequence?
It's revealed like further into season six, like, because we're wondering who's the new puppet leader of Cardassia, and then we are introduced to one Leggett Damar.
Right.
He's not a Gull. He's not a Glynn.
Right.
He's a Leggett now.
And Damar becomes I find him a fascinating character.
So do I. Yeah.
And I'm definitely a guy you want to watch again because you're like. Okay, because there's a lot of thought. I mean, this was it was a brilliant choice by the showrunners, and it carried forward, and it made DS9 stand out in a way that, I mean, I don't think is reflected in any other series at all.
No, until maybe Star Trek Discovery, but it
we'll
took.
We'll see.
We'll see. It's you know, fingers crossed. But you know, it's been many. You know, as we said, 20 years ago. Yeah. You know, this seven-parter kicks off, and. it's taken 20 years to potentially get something that's going to try to do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other example of that time was Babylon 5 was doing some of that too.
Yes,
it was doing some serialization too, right? So, you know, I mean, I watched a little bit, but I never got into it. I didn't know who the characters were and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you were aware that this was sort of, well, that's kind of neat. Why don't more shows do this?
Yeah.
Anyway, it was great. It was a great time, and thanks for bringing me in to talk about it.
Groovy.
Guys, gotta say this. Dominion War Arc, it's gonna go down in history. And that's why we made note of this for its 20th birthday party right here. This making history right now, guys.
Definitely.
We're all part. Okay, that's all. Okay, Cam, I didn't say join hands. I don't know what you're trying to do right now, but okay. I'll do it.
We'll start seeing Kumbaya in tribute.
I was going to go for a seance. You know, okay. Bring about the prophets to come speak to us.
Okay.
Load up the Tetracell White.
I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of the 7-episode Dominion War arc. Are you as big a fan as we are? What do you think are some of its shortcomings or some of the great moments we did not mention? Tyler, we're also on Facebook.
Yeah, go to facebook.com/subspacepod. Like us there, follow us. We're going to be putting out a lot of extra content, especially when Star Trek Discovery starts. So don't miss anything. It's going to get bigger and bigger. We're going to get busier and busier, and not everything's going to be available here on the audio podcast. So video, blogs, they're all in the works at this point. So keep following us on Facebook.
Definitely. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Well, I think everyone's abuzz right now about Seth MacFarlane's The Orville, aren't you?
Cricket.
Okay, well, you know what? Everybody's talking about it enough. I think you and I, we need to sit down, give it a shot. So we're going to do an episode I like to call The Orville versus Star Trek. See what people are talking about, why Seth MacFarlane has such a big passion for Star Trek. This is essentially a big ode to Star Trek, so I think it's worth a critical examination, and I think it's going to be interesting, especially when you have Discovery on the air at the same time that the Orville is on the air as well. There might be a little bit of rivalry going on.
That rivalry's already started, and it's been witless. But I look forward to wading into it myself.
Nice.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vorta Art Critic Smith.
You can find me at Reporton, that's REPORTON, N as in Napoleon equals Ducat.
Okay, and Dave?
You can find me at Doc Boris, that's at DOCBORYS, S as in, I don't have anything clever to add to that.
How about Space Nine?
Now, Dave, you also have a podcast that I'd like to let our listeners know about.
I do. I got a couple things to plug, if you guys let me just get crazy here.
Sir.
First thing, absolutely. The podcast that I run is called Cool Canadian History. It's a biweekly podcast on Canadian history. It deals with all subject matter. You can find it on coolcanadianhistory.com. You can also find Cool Canadian History on Facebook and on your podcast app. And I got to drop a little tag for a show that I'm going to be the lead historian on. It starts this Wednesday night. It'll be on every Wednesday on APTN for the next 10 weeks. It's called Nations at War.
Oh.
And it's a look at the First Nations military struggles during the sort of struggle for domination over the continent as the Europeans were arriving, which is very fitting for what we were kind of talking about today, sort of global conflict.
Yeah, if you definitely consider all the controversy of the Canada 150 birthday and how Indigenous people were not all aboard with Canada celebrating 150 years of conquest, I think this is like a good kind of reflection on that.
Absolutely. It's a great answer to it. It shows you that the First Nations people were not sort of these passive recipients of European domination, but were in fact active participants in the global conflict or the continental conflict.
Yeah.
And that'll be on APTN on Wednesday nights.
Excellent. Also, awesome. I am a subscriber to Dave's podcast.
Yes, me too.
You don't have to be cool. You don't have to be Canadian.
Nope.
You don't even have to know much history. You learn a lot, and it's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Dave, I give you my blessing. Keep at it.
Thank you for your blessing.
You're welcome.
This show will make you as cool as a Canadian.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys. I always appreciate coming on here, and it's always a pleasure to get to chat and nerd it up with you guys a bit.
Awesome. So until next time, the arena is closed.
complete.